there are overwhelming, turbulent times, but that also means there is major potential to fill the cracks with new ideas and to transform these destructive systems. There are specific root causes for problems and holistic solutions everywhere. There is room for prosperity, there is room for regeneration and a shift in values. Another reality is possible, and that's what we're exploring here today. Welcome to Sage Talking.
My name is Lydia Frie Kraft, and I come from Ghana in a very small village. I have a bachelor in Silviculture and Forest Management in Ghana at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology, and a master in International Management of Forest Industries at Bern University of Applied Sciences. And yeah, at the moment I am working for the German Wood Trade Federation, mainly providing consultation to German and European wood importers about the European timber trade regulation. Starting from this year, I'm also going to be the responsible person for certification in the company.
Why did you focus on forests, or why is that a topic of interest to you?
That is a very long story, but I'll make it short. So my father is a farmer, a cocoa farmer, and at the same time we were producing our own food. And around this time, he was working hand in hand with agric extension officers, mainly to do field trials. They get new variety, maize variety or cassava or plantain variety. They will come, we will do the experiments in our farms, and he was working really closely with them, and whatever the outcome, they will write papers and all about it, and then my father will be the one to train other farmers in our village and around. And I was really impressed with the work of the extension officers at that time. Little girl in the village, it was impressive the respect that they get, their knowledge, and how they can say certain things about certain when it can rain, and it indeed rains on this day. And it was interesting for me, so I also decided to study agriculture in high school so that I can also become an extension officer. And there I also learned that there is a relationship between trees and crops, so that is agroforestry, and that also deepened my interest. So in the university, I then decided to study silviculture. So basically, from the point of raising trees from seeds until they become a forest. So silviculture and forest management. Yes, and the interest didn't die. Even though I studied silviculture and forest management, I wrote my master thesis about cocoa. So climate change adaptation and cocoa production. And my master also, I did it again in the field of international management of forest industries, as I said in the introduction, but I also focus on cocoa because that is the work that my family's occupation, and that is the passion, and at the same time that was the dream, basically to really see what kind of relationship crops or trees have on crops.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your childhood, also the farm. You know, cocoa farming, I think, is a very interesting topic. I don't know if when you go into a grocery store, if you look at chocolate differently than many other people would. But what maybe you can give us a little picture of where you grew up so people can visualize it a little. What did it look like, and what was it like growing up on a cocoa farm?
Well, as I mentioned in my introduction, I grew up in a very small cocoa farming village. Around 2008, there were about 1,500 inhabitants, and around 2008, there was no until April 2008, there was no electricity. No, 2018, sorry, 2018, because that was when I officially came to Germany. So this is for me a very important date. April 2018, we had electricity. So I grew up in a village where I was using the moon when there is full moon. I was using the moon to study sometimes, and I was using a kerosene lamp. Sometimes you pick a thing, a milk or a milk tin. You pick your old clothes. You put it in the kerosene and you make a hole at the top. You put this hole through. You pour kerosene in it. You light it, and that is what you use to study. We used to call it bobo, or it's called bobo. That is what I used to study. And my father, as I also have mentioned, was a cocoa farmer. We were producing our own foodstuff and all. However, we didn't have enough money to employ working hands on the farm. So the children were basically the helping hands on the farm. So if you go to school, I was lucky to go to school. We go to school, you close from school, you walk to the farm, which is roughly 30 to an hour. We had different farms. We had farms where we had our cocoa farm, we had also oil palm plantation, and then we had our food crops farm. And my father was hiring the land because it didn't belong to him. So wherever we get land this year, we establish our farm and then we move. So roughly between 30 to an hour on foot. So that is what I was doing every day after school. We walk to the farm, about 30 to an hour, depending on which farm they are. And there you have lunch. And then you work on the farm. We were using machete to weed. And then we will help my mother. So my father had two wives at the time. We will help my mother to harvest food stuff and come home. And sometimes if we had to sell some to be able to buy fish or meat for dinner, then we will come home with my mothers. We will carry on our head with a piece of cloth to support. You carry the thing, the last on your head, come home. Then the kids will be sent to go and sell some so that my mothers can get some of the money to buy fish or meat or other vegetables that we don't have in our farm that we need to use to cook. Yes, and sometimes if there's no water, we also have to come home again with my mothers to then go and fetch water so that they can get water for cooking, because we didn't have running water and we didn't have wells around. So we usually walk like 15 minutes to go, and we can go two or three times depending on how fast we are, and then come and help with the chores. And if we don't have to do any of these things, then we will stay there in the farm with my father. The children will stay with my father to continue working, and then my mothers will come home and then cook. And sometimes we're coming with a moon at home, because in Ghana it's so it's like this, that 6 o'clock the sun goes down, and then from 6 it changes completely to being dark. And sometimes if we are coming home then at 7 or 8, then we come home with the moon. So that was how my childhood was.
What for you are maybe like the main, let's say, differences in how people here value different resources like water, food? What were some things where you would say that very much even shocked you, or that make you feel maybe even uncomfortable here, where you say the way that people relate to and treat resources?
You mentioned these two points quite right, because water and food are the most abundant resources, well, in Germany and or in Europe. And I think the Europeans have too much of everything. They have too much of everything. And water, for me, water is very important for me. Not because of the fact that the water level is reducing, but because of my experience as a child. As I said, sometimes after going to school, you go to the farm and then you come back, you're very tired, and then you still have to go 2 or 3 times. And we were walking like 15 minutes to a well where we're not the only people fetching, the entire village and then the surrounding villages. So about 1,500 people are coming, not at once, but everyone is coming to fetch from this well. And yeah, you go, you fetch, and then you carry it home, you pour it in another barrel, and then you go again, and then you go again. And sometimes if you are even carrying the water and somehow fall, you know, because you are carrying it on your head not a covered container, but in an open container. So if some are pouring over, you are already upset at yourself, because in the end you will get home with half of it. Or if you fight with a friend on the way and then they push you and your water pours away, then you have to go back again. And sometimes if you don't come back early, you are also being beaten at home because you didn't come back early. And if your father comes back from the farm and there's no water there, because he didn't get water to shower or to drink because there's no water, you are beaten. So, I mean, I have a different opinion about water. And one thing that maybe the Europeans will not even imagine it is that during the dry season, you know, as I mentioned, we had other sources of water there. But this well that I was going to was the main source of water. And sometimes you go there, the dry seasons, and all the water bodies around have dried up. Why? Because again, that is my interest, why I studied forestry. Another reason, we had bamboo plants all around this well where we are fetching our water, and it prevented from evaporating. So all the water bodies around my village and the surrounding villages will dry up. So all the people will come, and sometimes people wake up at 4 a.m. to bring their barrels to join a queue. And you go and there is a long queue, you are even disappointed. Sometimes you are lucky to get a muddy, because they fetch it so much, you use a tube with a rope, you send it down, you wait, the tube gets filled. So a leather tube, you pull it. And then sometimes you are even happy if you get a muddy water at the end, because they fetch you so much that it's dry, everything is gone, and people have to wait. So people bring their barrels to go to the farm to come and join the queue. And then there is an elderly person there, a respected person standing there at the well, making sure that the strong ones don't push the children away to fetch the water. So really, just like if you watch something about the savannah where the animals, the strong ones, are fighting over water, this is also my childhood, where really people have to stand there to regulate. No, it's your turn, you fetch, it's your turn, you fetch. And sometimes we if we are not able to wake up early to go and join this queue, we sit there until 7:30, and then we have to come home, leave our barrels there, our containers there, come home. And without shower, you go to school. And then in the afternoon, you go and try your luck again. Because after 7:30, you have to leave, or you'll be late for school. So this was the experience I made as a child. And if you consider food, you also mentioned the points of food. I think the Europeans, again, have too much food that sometimes it's quite sad if you see how much food is being thrown away in the evenings. I remember in Switzerland, you go to Migros or Aldi or Coop in the evening, and you see the amount of food that is being thrown away in the container, the containers to be thrown away. So in the end, some of the students were collecting them and bringing them to the university and putting them on a table where people can just pick some and then bring and eat. But in my village, it was much different. I remember several instances where we finished eating. For me, for me and my family, we always had food because we were producing our own food. But then I remember instances where in the evening, after eating the ones that we are not able to eat, my mother will collect them, will put them together nicely, and then will bring it to my neighbor's children. And that is their dinner. It's not because their families are lazy or something, but it's just so hard that at the end of the day, they are not able to provide 3 square meals. This is not just what you hear in the news or something. This is really what I have experienced, what I have witnessed, that at the end of the day, the parents don't have money to cook, and you hear a child crying, not because it has done something and the parents are beating it or something, but because it's hungry. And well, that is what a European child will not understand. And this is what sometimes I get upset also at my children, when they sit here and then they tell you they don't want this or they don't want that, and I tell them, go to Ghana, you'll be happy with whatever you get, and you wouldn't have a choice to say this or that. And then again, I think European children don't even know what hunger is.
Yeah.
Because for people here, hunger is, okay, my mother delayed 30 minutes or something, and then there's no food, so the next 30 minutes, oh, I'm so hungry. But for children like us, hunger would be that your parents don't know what is coming on the table this evening, and they don't know what is coming the next morning.
What does sustainable production mean to you, especially regarding then forestry and timber? Because I think for many people, the words sustainable, they mean a lot of different things and are often today not very descriptive of what maybe some of the original meanings of it are. So what does it mean to you? How would you define it?
Yeah, I would define sustainable resource use as taking them today, taking enough of what we need, and making sure that my children and their children would also be able to use the resource. So taking some and replanting in terms of forestry.
Do you think that taking something, or in forest management, let's say also in Germany, do you think it's enough for sustainability to, let's say, cut down trees, harvest them, and then replant them? Or is there more for you that goes into really ensuring sustainability, the let's say transgenerational sustainability, as you talked about, for your kids and grandchildren?
Yes, I think so. And I think yeah, you can achieve that in Germany, and it's already been done. It's either you use the resources or you lose it. I believe in that, and I believe that forest management in Germany and in Europe in general is very much advanced, and you have a forest management plan which states categorically how many years you are allowed to cut, so annual allowable cut, and then how the regeneration should follow.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, if you consider the issues with bark beetle and clear cutting as a result of bark beetles spoiling the forest, then it's not really a sustainable management. However, or because of climate variations, looking at drought and then farmers having to cut everything, then you would say it's not a sustainable forest management. But in the long run, I think the forests in Europe are managed sustainable enough. And if you compare this to where I'm coming from in Ghana, usually they don't do any management. You just cut, they don't plant. You cut and then you allow for natural regeneration. So the forest canopy is opened, and then there is a sunlight on the forest floors, and then the old seeds that were dropped down get to germinate, and then survival of the fittest, the strong ones are able to survive, and then they are able to grow and then become emergent trees and so on and so forth. So yes, I would say sustainable forest management is possible, and it's actually been practiced in Germany. And yeah, I believe that we have to use the resources, the wise use. We shouldn't spoil it, but we have to use it in a wise way so that tomorrow our children can come and use it.
Yeah, and because my question there would be, because many people argue, and we're seeing it also, that many forests in Germany, and also that there was a lot of dying of forests also over the last year, as you said, with also extreme droughts, climate variations, and then the bark beetle, which in my opinion is more, you know, a symptom of a not sustainable management of forestry. And I mean, many people, I think, would argue, who think more, let's say, regeneratively than sustainably, argue that if you let a forest recover by itself, obviously not when you're cutting down, but let's say if a forest, if there was a storm or extreme drought in 1 year, and there is, for example, dead wood, that you should leave it and let the forest regenerate on its own. And many people argue that forestry in Germany is indeed not really sustainable, and that a lot of it is very industrial age thinking. So what for you would sustainable production and harvesting, or the use of the resource forest, look like for you if you would stand, let's say, in one of our forests here? How would you describe it?
Well, as I've already explained, for me, sustainable forest management or sustainable forest resource use means wise use. It's not about looking and managing the forest for biodiversity, leaving the plant for ant and insect. That is another aspect of forest management, where you consider biodiversity and you leave everything to rot, untouched forest. No, but for me, I think the forest has to be used. So the wood has to be cut, and then again, as a forester or forest engineer, I make sure that you do selection, which tree to remove in order to favor the other one. So I know that in 10 years, I'm going to cut this one, and then this one is putting shade over it. So I'll remove this one. And then again, if you consider the aspect of bark beetle, then if this thing comes in there, if you have bark beetle, then the wise way will be to cut everything because it will spread. But then another way to manage it in a sustainable way is also to do mixed planting. So not only spruce, but also Douglas fir, for example, or broadleaves tree species. So in the end, you don't only have the temperate, or how should I say them, the needle trees, but then you also have the broadleaves. That is a way to manage it sustainably if you are looking in terms of the drought resistance varieties, and then again bark beetle. But then I am my definition of sustainable forest management will be wise use, to cut it, to use it, to promote others, and then to plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because I think so I would say sustainable use for you is that also then economically informed, because I mean, you could leave a forest, you could, you know, you could have the forest, let's say, how they were the commons, let's say, in the Middle Ages, where everybody could access the forest and maybe cut down, you know, some wood, harvest some wood, use it only for themselves, for their family. But obviously forestry here is an industry, and people wouldn't make money off it by just leaving forests also untouched. And I mean, would you say that in the way they're managed now, most forests in Germany, because we have seen a lot of forests dying, especially, let's say, in the upper regions also of Germany, that could actually be sustained, this type of forestry that is done right now?
To manage the forest sustainably in the sense of, or economically, you know, so I will put sustainable forest management under three pillars. So you have to consider first the social aspect, the human aspect. The human aspect is to use it. And then you have to consider the ecological aspect. Is it wise to cut this one? And then the economic aspect. Because, for example, my father-in-law also has a forest. And again, he's managing the community forest here in Buch am Erlbach. And then you realize that the past 7 years, it has not been economically sustainable, the way the forest is being managed, because most of them are being cut down because of bark beetle, and you have to remove them. And you get, if you bring it to the sawmill people, you don't get the value which under normal circumstance the wood you accrue. You don't get this because they say, okay, bark beetles have spoiled it. At the end of the day, they will use the same wood for the same purpose, but because this farmer has to cut his, the other farmer has to cut his, and then the other, at the end of the day, you cut everything because you don't have a choice. Either you use it or you lose it. You don't cut it now, then you lose your entire forest to a bark beetle.
I understand that, but I mean, bark beetle is also just, or more bark beetles are just a symptom, you know, of climate change and also a not very strong forest, because I mean, most forests here are not very old. They are very young and they're always in succession. They're always harvested and then replanted. I mean, in my opinion, not every forest has to be economically used, because I mean, let's say a really old forest, like for example, the redwood forests in the US, or a lot of other forests around the world, we don't have many old forests anymore in Germany, like really old growth forests, or like they have in Canada. In your opinion, do you think every forest has to be economically used? Because I mean, there's so much value we derive from healthy, thriving ecosystems where, or a forest where we don't use the wood, but we derive a lot of other benefits from the forests, like other, let's say, what the Western world would call ecosystem services.
Yeah, if you are a farmer, you have a forest standing somewhere, would you just let it be there, not do anything, no harvest, not do anything? You have hundred thousands of bark beetles dancing around in there. Will you just leave them because of the ecological aspect?
Well, I think if, you know, I had the skill to create a forest, you know, I mean, some people plant forests, especially in let's say a lot of South American countries, or areas around the Amazon. There are some amazing stories from people who have upforested or actively helped a piece of forest regenerate so it could, you know, just be there for plants to live in, for animals to live in, for a lot of biodiversity to flourish, to hold water, to retain water, etc., to provide clean air. So I think if I had a forest and my livelihood didn't depend on it, I wouldn't use a forest economically, but I would try and support the forest so that it would be strong enough, because I mean, every forest or ecosystem is only susceptible, I think, to get completely destroyed by disease if it's not strong, you know, if it's compromised in some way. And I think if it's not owned by an individual farmer, but let's say by the town or by a city, I think that some forests need to be, you know, just be, don't you think so?
No, I think I have another opinion on this, because and I like it that where you mentioned two things. I will base my point on one was that if you don't, your livelihood does not depend on it, and one is if it's not owned by an individual. So first, touching the first point, in Bavaria, the biggest forest area are owned by the areas are owned by private enterprise or private bodies in the part the where this Adelaide's families and all, they own the biggest forest areas in Bavaria and in Germany, 20,000 hectares and 10,000 and 5,000 hectares. Honestly speaking, you cannot compare this to somewhere in Amazon or Wesa or anywhere in the world where someone has 1 acre and wants to use it to save the world. These people are profit oriented and they want to manage their forest. Their first interest is the economical aspect.
Yeah, of course.
And for them, yeah, you can think of sustainability, but then if they have they detect that there's bark beetle, then they have to clear everything so that it doesn't spoil so that the forest doesn't lose its value. It is not so realistic, especially in Germany, in Bavaria, to say we leave the forest for ecological purposes, for recreation, for relaxation. And I think Germany is remarkable. I've not been to a lot of countries, but it's very remarkable. If you compare Germany or Switzerland to my country, it's remarkable how much forests they leave for recreation. You can walk in the forest, take a walk, you can jog, you can bike, you can go with your family, you even do forest a kindergarten. I never heard of it where I'm coming from. Yeah. And that is where we are supposed to have a lot of the word forest in the tropics. So I think at the end of the day, you need to find a balance. That's why I would put sustainable forest management under three pillars. You'll find a balance where the people, the humans who are the custodians of the resources, their interest is one pillar, and then the ecological aspect, the environmental aspect is one pillar, and then the economic aspect, and it has to go hand in hand. One shouldn't be stronger than the other, then the pillar will break. For me personally, if I'm managing the world forest, if I'm managing the Bavarian forest, I will place it under three pillars. What do the people need? We want to walk in the forest. So I'll make sure that, for example, after there is a storm, I remove the hanging trees or the not so stable trees so that people can walk with their families safely. And then again, I will think of the forester to make sure that I plant mixed varieties of tree species so that and tree species that are resistant to the changing climate, so that when there is bark beetle, it will not affect all the trees, so that when there is storm, it will not throw all the spruce with long no branch with long crowns, but then or canopy, but then they are also broadleaf with different branches, so that when there is storm, it will not throw everything away.
Yeah.
And then I will think of the economic aspect. Which tree should I remove this year to favor this one in the next 5 years? Or how much shade is this tree casting on this tree? And does it make sense to remove this? So for me, if I'm managing the forest, or basically what the theory I learned in school, which I think is also, it makes a lot of sense if you were to put it in practice, I would put sustainable forest management under three pillars.
And I think obviously, you know, it's good to open up these conversations because there are a lot of different perspectives, experiences, viewpoints surrounding the same topic. As you said, we can have differences in opinion. That's nice. That enriches the conversation. I think personally that, let's say, the ecological aspect is falling too short, because right now, in my opinion, it's human needs first. And since we rely on Earth and Earth thriving on our own thriving, I think that generally also in Germany, it's looked at always the human needs first, which I think puts those pillars that you described so nicely out of balance. And obviously you can also never compare, like, let's say, forests in the Amazon, forests in Kenya or China to the forests we have here, let's say more specifically in the region of Bavaria, and how they are used. But in my opinion, I think it's not the, let's say, the forest that then should be managed in a way that it also serves us humans, so that it fits in this economic scenario and that you could in some way call it sustainable. And even if you said it's better than other countries, I think that certainly doesn't mean that it's good or that it's ideal. So I think it would be rather more that we have to change our economic needs and economic models so that we can support nature and earth in its thriving. That's kind of like my viewpoint that I'm coming from, but I'm also obviously coming from another angle because I don't have your background and the studies that you did, so obviously we have formed different opinions, but I think it's very nice to exchange the different, you know, factors and viewpoints. And you're obviously helping to make it, let's say, more sustainable, the use and the production in the current economic scenario. Because if it were a different one, I think your job description of managing sustainably would also be a different one if it was a different economic scenario. In a different economy where there were different needs and demands, let's say less intensive demands, that your job would allow you to make different regulations? Or do you find that what you have to provide in your job, the advice, if you say, you know, it's for sustainable production, that's kind of informed by the current economy? Because it is how it is, you know? Mm-hmm. And you can't change the economy today, even if you had different ideas for forestry.
Well, I think the European Union is already doing enough. Maybe it's not the best, but they are doing enough. If you consider the 10-year-old European timber trade regulation, which is basically what I do every day at work, the main aspect of this European timber trade regulation is to make sure that wood that is being imported into the EU has been harvested legally according to the laws and the regulations of the country of harvest. And now they realize that wood can be harvested legally, but at the same time it can be deforested. The entire forest area can be cleared legally if the government, for example, which is happening a lot in the Western and then the Eastern Africa, where a lot of Chinese companies are taking over, buying forest lands, clearing them, and then establishing companies and all kinds of things. So the forest can be sold by the government. In this case, it's legal, but they need to be cleared. Or the forest can be cleared, be changed from in the Amazons. It happens a lot in Indonesia and Malaysia. It can be cleared from forest to palm oil plantation or soya plantation. The area has been sold to these commercial entities. It's legal, but it's again deforestation. So with the European deforestation free supply chain, which was passed on the 29th of June last year and is supposed to enter into force and on the 30th of December 2024, so this year, end of this year, we are supposed to implement it, or wood importers are supposed to implement it. And this, the EUDR, as its wood importers are supposed to ascertain that wood that is, or wood products, including other six commodities, soya, cow meat, rubber, cocoa, coffee, and oil palm, that is being imported into the European Union has not contributed to deforestation or forest degradation. The laws and the rules of the country of harvest has also been respected, including the principles of free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous people, that is FPIC. And then again, including the workers' right, the labor right, no child labor, all these rights. So the laws of the country of harvest has been respected, and it has not contributed to deforestation or forest degradation. So this alone, if wood importers make sure that the wood that they are bringing to the European Union has not contributed to this aspect, this alone, I think, will go a long way to mark or to give a green lane to a lot of the aspect of sustainable forest management. And that is why I think the EU is doing a lot. Maybe not enough, but they are doing a lot at the moment.
Also, I want to acknowledge and honor Indigenous and First Nations peoples as custodians of most of planet Earth's biodiversity and bearers of ancient knowledge. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize all Indigenous and First Nations peoples' strength, resilience, and deep connection to nature. Thank you.